Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome to this week's Tech Weekly, a podcast for everyone from the techno purist to the techno curious. Due to breaking news and Apple announcements at Macworld yesterday, today's podcast is being released a day later than usually scheduled. However, I'm still Alex Krotowski, and here with me in the studio are Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur, who've spent the past 7 days consuming and digesting what's been going on in the world of gadgetry and geekery so we can bring you the latest in the style of haute cuisine. But before we say hello to them, let's bring in our man on the street, Bobby Johnson, who's been pounding the pavement in fabulous Las Vegas over the past week, digging the dirt on the latest gadgetry and inventions. Bobby's been at the Consumer Electronics Show, he's been at Macworld, and now, Bobby, where in the world are you?
I have no idea, frankly. I'm on another planet, I think. After I wore my feet down to bloody stumps in Vegas, now I'm indulging in a bit of free love. Maybe get some tattoos here in San Francisco. Yeah.
Back to the studio. Hello, Charles.
Hi.
You doing? And Jemima's over there.
Hello.
In the corner. Hello. It has been a big week of announcements and unveilings at CES. What's inflated your personal balloons? Anything of interest?
From CES?
Yeah.
Oh, the butt kicker was quite funny, wasn't it? This is basically a giant, great sort of unit you clip onto your chair and it belts you every time there's vibrations in your game.
That's fantastic.
Interesting.
That's like, Charles, has anything rocked your technological world in CES?
I mean, in the CES thing, I really like the idea of the Minority Report computer, the one you sort of wave your arms at. I was just trying to imagine what an office would look like if you had an office full of all the cubicles.
I think there'll be a lot of accidents.
I think, yeah, you definitely need to have some kind of...
You'd have an eye out with that.
Rather like when the Wii launched.
I think health and safety would have something to say about it, wouldn't they, really?
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll be dissecting some of those issues later in the show. As for the rest, we'll be talking with the grandpappy of new media and technology, One Laptop Per Child founder Nicholas Negroponte, and we'll be diving into the biggest headlines over the past week and the weird and wonderful from the blogs. Expect to be scintillated. But we start with Macworld. Bobby, what are the big announcements?
Well, the answer was pretty much what the rumour mill had predicted, actually. A new ultra-thin Apple laptop called the MacBook Air and a deal to allow movie rentals over iTunes. Now, it's been a pretty foggy day here in San Francisco, which isn't that unusual. But what did stand out were the thousands of journalists and a horde of excited fans who crowded into the Moscone Center to hear what Apple boss Steve Jobs had to unveil.
It's so thin... It even fits inside one of these envelopes that we've all seen floating around the office. And so let me go ahead and show it to you now. This is the new MacBook Air, and you can get a feel for how thin it is. Full-size keyboard, full-size display. It's the world's thinnest notebook.
Now, as I said, the biggest issue was this MacBook Air, which is just 3/4 of an inch deep at its thickest point. It's got a 13-inch screen, a multi-touch trackpad, and it comes with a pretty high spec, including Core Duo chips and 2 GB of RAM. Now, the price isn't as slim as the computer. It's going to set you back at least £1,200 in the UK, but it really had the crowds here worked up.
I think it's pretty cool, and I think a lot of our customers are going to enjoy it because just of the convenience of the weight. Not sure about the external media at this point, but that remote disc seems to be pretty cool. So leading technology, pretty neat.
It's very nice. I like the gestures, kind of bringing the iPhone feel into the laptop. That's neat.
And do you think it's going to stand up to being carried around? It's so thin.
I don't know. The biggest thing for me is hard drive size. It's pretty small at 60, if they can get bigger, or 80. You know, it's like it's not much bigger hard drive than my iPod, so I like to get bigger.
Elsewhere, there was a series of software updates for the iPhone and the iPod Touch, as well as the so-called Time Capsule, which is a router that's got a built-in hard disk and automatically backs up your computer over wireless. But it's actually the new reinvigorated Apple TV that I find most interesting. That's able to hook straight up to your TV without needing a computer anymore, and it can stream movies and shows directly from the internet onto your telly. Now, that means that the little white box that they launched here a while ago could finally start to fulfill some of that promise and take Apple further into new territory, even taking on the cable and satellite companies at their own game. Now, Jobs admitted that Apple TV hadn't set the world on fire before, so he introduced what he said was Take Two. And there were deals there with pretty much every major Hollywood studio to allow rental over the air. The speculation might have been fairly accurate, but we didn't get everything on the rumour list. There was no tablet-style computer and no 3G iPhone, for example. But still, it doesn't look like that or the foggy weather has dampened the excitement of the fans thronging the expo hall.
Thanks, Bobby. We'll come back to you in a bit. But first, here's the news.
UK iTunes users will pay around 10% less for their music after a ruling by the European Commission forced Apple to harmonise pricing across Europe. Triggered by complaints from consumer group Which, the move will take effect within 6 months and coincides with UK government proposals to legalise personal music copying. Sony BMG has joined the other big three music labels to sell music in the popular DRM-free format through online retail giant Amazon. The label will offer its entire catalogue in the format by the end of the month, the latest move by an industry trying to challenge Apple's dominance of the online music market. The US writers' strike has triggered a traffic boom for video sharing sites like YouTube and MetaCafe, which have seen an 18% surge in user numbers since the strike began 2 months ago. Turned off by repeats and pulled shows, viewers have been tuning into specialist content like the comedy site Crackle. Jeff Rakes, president of Microsoft's $16 billion business division, is to retire after 27 years and will be replaced by Stephen Elop, currently chief operating officer at Juniper Networks. Meanwhile, the 71-year-old former Intel chief and Parkinson sufferer Andy Grove has revealed that he has donated $22 million to research the disease. Grove said he kept his condition quiet because he didn't want to be a poster child for the disease. "This thing makes me look like an old man, and I'm a vain guy."
Thank you very much, Jemima. That was very uplifting, indeed. I'm particularly interested in the YouTube story and how that the writer's strike is really trickling throughout the entirety of the media landscape.
Yeah, this is very exciting, yes, because obviously there have been lots of repeats on American television with the networks desperate to kind of plug all those holes that have been caused by shows like David Letterman and All Sorts being pulled. People obviously have gone straight on the internet because they know exactly where to go. And
Letterman's
one
of those few shows that actually has got going, hasn't it? Letterman's done a few, though.
He's started back now.
To show that he's in touch with the writers.
The figures are from Nielsen Online and they monitor the last 2 months. And there's sites like Dailymotion and Crackle, the comedy site. And they've all seen online viewing surge. And YouTube has shot up by 18%. So it's great news for them and also for the kind of long tail of content. So maybe it's a chance for people to explore a bit of content they might not have found otherwise.
The bizarre thing is that it means that all the studio's arguments about how, you know, people don't really use the internet for, you know, it's just a promotional thing for the TV is actually being overturned by it because, you know, people are saying, hey, if we can't get it on the TV, then we'll go and get it on YouTube.
Well, I mean, and there we also have to say there's a fairly high probability that a lot of the stuff they're watching online is pirated. And obviously that will be professional content. But a lot of sites like Bebo and MySpace have a lot of kind of legitimate professional content online now. And it's also quite nice to think that some sort of small indie producers or people just doing more amateur stuff, but really interesting stuff, might be finding a new audience.
And speaking actually of the social networking elements, we're going to speak a little bit about Facebook in a bit. But one of the things that you didn't mention was that Cambridge University's admissions policy, people are starting to look at Facebook pages for their applicants, which is quite an interesting thing.
Well, yes, but Bobby actually wrote a story and said that it might be illegal for people to look up your social networking profiles. It's an invasion of privacy. Maybe
surely you get a clue if it sort of says a Cambridge University professor wants to be your friend.
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a giveaway.
I wonder why that would be.
Bobby, how does that work with the illegality of looking up somebody's Facebook page?
I think it's just a pretty unclear situation at the moment. It's about the information that might be out there but is kind of semi-private, or if an admissions tutor or somebody or a potential employer uses a kind of nefarious secret identity to try and friend you and find information out about you.
I guess you could also sort of look for photos that are tagged with that person's name and see if you can match a photo which might be on someone else's more public profile or something like that, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the idea that it's not just your privacy you have to worry about, but all your friends, everybody you ever mention or take photos of, yeah.
Well, I think we're definitely going to be looking more at that in the future. But there is more tech news throughout the week at guardian.co.uk/technology if you need to get your technology news for the rest of the week. But back to Bobby now, who you've had a very, very busy last week. How was it for you?
Crazy, I think, is the simplest way to put it. I mean, technology journalists like to moan a bit about CES and how big it is and everyone in the industry. But, you know, you can't underestimate the size of it. It's enormous. We all get blisters wandering around. Now, it's a few days later, I can look back at it and say I saw some pretty cool stuff.
Happy New Year, and welcome to the 2008 International CES, where entertainment, technology, and business converge.
It's kind of appropriate that CES is held in Las Vegas, because just like the city itself, everything here is about being bigger and better than your rivals, and that's why everybody dedicates so much time and energy to the show. The biggest story in the halls has really been that switch by Warner Brothers to Blu-ray and Toshiba's nervous breakdown that came as a response. But elsewhere, it's kind of been business as usual. It's who's got the biggest, who's got the fastest, the smallest, the shiniest new gadgets.
One of the centrepieces of the show so far seems to have been the world's largest TV screen, which is over here. Now, it's an absolute monster from Panasonic. Comes in at 150 inches. Now, until now, the biggest ones have been kind of 103, 108 inches. The resolution on it is huge, 2,000 pixels by 4,000, which is way in advance of what we see on HD screens at the moment. Now, the measurements are 6 feet high and 12 feet across. Comes in, weighs in a quarter of a ton, so, you know, don't go trying to lug one around your house. And it's going to cost you £50,000 if you try and buy one.
So we're here with Sanyo, who are marketing what they're calling the world's shortest throw projector. Now, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but it sounds very interesting. Let's find out. Mark, can you explain what this technology is and what it does?
Yes, the Sanyo PLC XL50 projector will give you a 80-inch diagonal image from only 3 inches away from the wall. So as we're showing here, we've got the projector butted directly up on the wall, and it's providing a 60-inch image. And the benefit is, for example, in a classroom on an interactive whiteboard, the instructor can be right up against the image, touch the image, and not have the light of the projector in their eyes.
The main thing here really is the sheer overwhelming size of the thing. There are 140,000 people trawling the halls. There are 2,700 exhibitors spread out all over the city. And there are hundreds of products being launched here. Now, most of them are updates of things we've seen in the past. They're kind of bigger memory, better screens, the next generation of existing products. It's all relatively pedestrian stuff, and it's aimed really at the industry buyers. But we have seen a few weird and wonderful gadgets on the loose.
We're with TN Games, who produce a product called Third Space. Now, this one's a bit strange, so John, I want you to tell me exactly what this is and how it works.
Okay, this is a gaming vest, a first-person shooter vest. It's spraying from medical technology. What we have in here are, you can kind of see this pneumatic cell, air bladder, if you will.
Yeah, there's a lump in the middle here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There are 8 of these. 4 in the front, 4 in the back. Basically, you put the vest on, you strap on in there, you play the game, and you are feeling what's happening in that video game. You're feeling getting the shots from the back or from the front.
Yeah, okay, so I'm gonna strap this on now, because I think, you know, there's nothing like trying these things out. Oh, I just got shot in the head. That's freaked me out completely. It's like someone poking me with a finger or something. Jabbing. They got me again. I'm no good at this. So if I sat and played this for hours on end, I'd probably end up with bruises or something.
No, this is a consumer game. And like I said, our CEO is a vascular surgeon.
He knows what he's talking about.
Health, and at the same time, we're into fun. This is fun part of gaming. We're not here to hurt you. We don't want you to get hurt. We just want you to experience what's happening in the game. You know, right now, you already have the sights. You already have the sounds. What would be the next best thing to jumping into that computer? And this is what we have for you. You can kind of feel the stabs, you feel the explosions, you feel the shots, things like that.
This is the new C2 Taser, made for, well, generally marketing to women this year with the leopard print, but it comes in a variety of colors. It comes in pink, hot pink, red for Valentine's Day, silver, and the bottom line is this also comes with a new case that has an MP3 player in the bottom. With this holster, you just clip it onto your belt. You can go out walking, jogging, whatever, and you have your MP3 player built in. But also, if you come across an attacker, a dangerous situation, you just flip it up, pull it back, which exposes the laser, okay? All you do is point at the target, press the button. Now, the whole concept is you shoot, you drop, and it will still cycling and keeping your attacker on the ground for 30 seconds, and you get the heck out of Dodge.
I've also just been having a play with the MyView Crystal, which is this pair of clear glasses you put on. And through it, you can actually watch video and kind of see what else is going on in the world at the same time. It's very strange and almost certainly not to everybody's taste. But, it's a bit of fun all the same. And finally, on top of the usual mix of entertainment and flash gadgets, we've also seen a few new themes coming out into the open this year, mainly around the ideas of kind of promoting environmentally friendly, sustainable, emerging technologies.
We're here with a company called MTech, who make a little gizmo called the Fuel Saver. Now, they claim this can make significant energy savings, but I'm a little baffled as to how it works. Can you just explain to us what exactly goes on here?
Sure, Bobby. This fuel sensor goes into the fuel tank. This one goes onto the radiator hose, and this one will go into the air cleaner. That'll give you a 20% fuel saving when installed in the vehicle.
Okay, I'm still surprised. It sounds fantastic, but there must be a catch. What's the science behind this?
This little thing here will, using nanotechnology, it creates a molecule reactive environment in the vehicle.
Come on, tell me the truth here. What's this going to cost me?
Well, it's going to cost $299. So if you spend $50 a week on fuel, in 12 months, it's more than paid itself off. And it lasts for over 10 years.
Bobby, that's quite a lot of stuff that you covered. No wonder you've got blisters all over your feet.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I really enjoyed was riding in the Boss, the robotic car from General Motors and DARPA. That was good fun, slightly scary.
Do you think that's going to be the keynote next year, is robot?
I hope so. I would wish for a kind of Godzilla-like robot to descend upon us all.
I just think there's an interesting question, which is, who are they going to get to do the keynote at CES next year? This is Bill Gates' last one. Steve Ballmer's not really going to cut it, is he? Because they've had enough Microsoft. Who are they going to ask? I mean, the obvious thing, because the company that's there doing $1 billion of business, except it's not actually there, is Apple. And of course, you know, every CES, people, you know, in the last couple of years, people have been saying, yeah, but what's Apple going to do? And the really interesting question would be, what if the organizers of CES think, that Steve Jobs guy, we should get him along because everyone pays attention to what the hell he does.
So, would he ever gazump Macworld?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I think if I were the Macworld organizers, I'd be Mr. Jobs, just want to make sure your diary's booked up for the next few years. And, I think this is the interesting question. Who's going to keynote CES next year?
Well, there's not necessarily a clash there, actually, between CES and Macworld, because Macworld's more about announcements, and CES is more about sort of observations and insights.
Which is why I would put in a couple of pence for Shigeru Miyamoto, who's the head of Nintendo, particularly with the waving of the arms and those kinds of interfaces. He seems to be the master at the minute, so he could be an interesting person to come
when
along.
Are they
but does he give
good
keynote?
The...
This is, the, I mean, yeah, I've met
he doesn't,
Shigeru
Miyamoto. He doesn't give great keynote. Thank you very much, Bobby. You can check out Bobby's grinning mug in the library of video from the show at guardian.co.uk/technology, where he shows off some of the gadgets that he talked about here.
I'm Alok Jha, and in the latest Science Weekly podcast, we discuss dream dinner party lineups with Caspar Melville, editor of the New Humanist magazine. He'd have Charles Darwin at the head of his table. Who would you choose? Also in the show, we talk game theory and social physics with Nobel Prize winner Roger Myerson. Plus, we hear from Arpad Pushtai, the scientist who kickstarted a controversy over the safety of GM food almost a decade ago. All this, and we'll tell you how to make your world a better place. It's not that hard, really. It's all in the new Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts.
What's been going on in the blogs this week? Jemima, I mentioned that we would be talking about Facebook. Now is the moment.
Tom Hodgkinson has opened a whole can of Facebook worms with his five-page extravaganza in G2 on Monday. He's basically exploring some very in-depth background to Facebook and its investors, to Peter Thiel, who's one of the key investors behind the firm. And he questions what he calls the commodification of human relationships and whether we should let a bunch of super geeks in California mediate our social lives.
I think he's a little bit late for that, to be honest, isn't he?
Well, maybe. I mean, there's been quite a lot of comment on this. And one of the comments said that they thought his understanding was quite thin about how the site actually worked. I don't know how much time Tom Hodgkinson has spent on the site, so I can't really answer that. But somebody else, Onion Gravy, referred to Stephen Fry's column on Saturday, and he said the internet, particularly Web 2, is supposed to be about open source, about access and information sharing. As a non-user of Facebook, I'm not even allowed to view a single page. And this isn't related necessarily to what Tom wrote, but it's a very interesting discussion point, actually. And obviously there's a balance between privacy and openness and information sharing. And
data
things,
capture, ultimately, yes, for Facebook.
Yes, which obviously is how they're going to monetize their site. And somebody else made the point that it's not free. You know, you've got to pay for it somehow.
Though I think the sort of suggestion that the internet is about, you know, this thing is about free, this, that, it isn't actually. You know, it's just a means of communication. It's as open or closed as the people who are at the ends choose to make it.
But people are getting increasingly more savvy about the value of their own information, and they're wanting to take as much of their stuff as possible onto other websites. Like Flickr, for example. I've got all my photos on there, but I'd love to be able to just stick them in on Facebook or on another site. The actual kind of the raw files, you know, you can bulk upload to Flickr. You can't bulk download out of Flickr in the same way. You know, you're still contributing a lot of information into a closed environment. And although things are moving away from that, it's, you know, not as open as it could be.
I think you bring up an interesting point about how people are starting to recognize the importance of their own information.
There's an interesting website that's started up in the States called mint.com, which is a financial site. So you can upload all your bank account details.
Boy, would I not do that.
And then it will analyze all your spending and say, right, you're spending loads on fuel. We'd recommend that you get this credit card instead because you get discount on fuel if you use that. Is that going to take off? I mean, obviously, the biggest challenge to them is trust. And
I think the biggest challenge is that a lot of banks' conditions say you're not allowed to give anyone else your password details and things like that. And that is, in effect, what you are doing with that site. Mm. So it sort of breaches a lot of conditions, you know, straight off the bat.
Well, this is a little bit of crystal ball gazing. It should be really interesting to see how that does play out. But earlier this week, before Macworld, actually, Charles, you were going to talk about some of the crystal ball gazing that the blog readers were doing about what the big announcement was going to be.
Oh, yeah. Following on from the article that was on the front of technology last week, we asked, you know, people, well, OK, so what do you think Apple's going to announce at Macworld? And just a few picks, you know, because you can now tell how right or wrong they were. Tom suggested an updated Apple TV with DVR capabilities that is able to record TV, tiny notebook, possibly a smaller iPhone, updated iPhone software, otherwise not much, and video, but not music rental. Doctor, I agree, Mac Mini, Apple TV combo, probably with optical drive, possibly Blu-ray, probably a subscription movie account. And Zippy suggested a new Mac to fit somewhere between the iMac and the Mac Pro. That's quite a broad range. Oh, okay, so it's a desktop of some sort. And an updated Apple TV goes without saying. Well, you said it. I also expect some type of new device, although who could guess what it will be? Okay, I think you left the field open there. And definitely a new iTunes.
That was quite a good bit of crystal ball gazing that we got from our readers, which I'm very thankful for. Mm. I actually continued the Apple trend because last week I asked for people to suggest games that I could play on my new Mac, because having been a PC girl for such a long time, I literally have no idea how to get and where to get computer games for the Mac. So we've had plenty of suggestions, including this one from Nick T. He says, I bought a couple of games on the Mac, Age of Empires and World of Warcraft, but I don't play them at all. The Mac mouse is perhaps just the most unwieldy device for gaming. It feels odd playing games on the Mac, which is not particularly comforting for somebody who's just got over
the Mac. It's strange because you can use any mouse, just plug any old mouse in.
That's true. The general conclusion from everybody is that you shouldn't play games on a Mac. Oops.
The last one I remember playing and really enjoying was Starship Titanic, which is back in the prehistoric days. But that was
very
a great
good
game.
Absolutely, a very good game. Thank you very much, everyone, for your suggestions, whether it's crystal ball gazing, commenting on Facebook, or offering me some advice when it comes to gaming on a Mac. You too can get involved in the debates as they happen, live and almost uncensored at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology. He's the technological free thinker who dreamed up MIT's Media Lab and the one laptop per child. Nicholas Negroponte has been part of the Web Digerati since the very beginning, documenting and supporting emerging technologies as they happen. Bobby, you managed to track him down between speaking engagements, and you asked him a few pressing questions about laptops, the developing world, and playing politics. Bobby, what's the story here?
Negroponte and the one laptop per child project have got a lot of press over the few years that they've been running. And increasingly recently, it seems to have been negative. And the split with Intel recently, where Intel pulled out of the project that they've had a kind of very tempestuous relationship with, has really upped the stakes, I think. And so, you know, we got a chance to talk to him. And I asked him, do you regret ever getting involved with Intel at all?
Well, hindsight allows you to make these kind of judgments. But the answer is yes, it would have been better had we never tried, because it takes a lot of effort. And then, of course, failing is no fun. And I think both sides will tell you we tried quite hard, but it just didn't work.
So the result of that really has been some kind of negative attention for the project, or certainly a lot of criticism from the kind of free market media, you know, the Wall Street Journal and The Economist have both kind of taken up arms against you almost as far as they can. I mean, do you think they're fundamentally misunderstanding what you're trying to do?
They're looking at it from the point of view of a business, and they're accepting the Intel line of argument that for some reason we're anti-competition. So, yes, they are taking those two and putting them together, and the result is quite clear. We're not anti-competition, of course, it's just the opposite. In fact, the more laptops, the better, the more opportunity kids, you know, have to be connected and to get laptops. One has to distinguish between competitive products and anti-competitive practices, and we were at a point we just couldn't reconcile it. So I don't think the details matter at all. If you look at some of the critiques, they tend to say that the market is doing it already, and if that were true, that's terrific. That's a great sign of success, and we should be very proud of that.
The very fact the project is running has clearly drawn the attention of major commercial manufacturers to start looking at these markets in a way they didn't before. But, I mean, the crucial thing from the competing products I've seen versus your one is that your one's a very different, it's a different kind of product specifically designed for very particular tasks.
It's different on so many levels. If you were to critique it, what you should do is critique for being too different in too many different areas. In other words, you almost can have one or two miracles, but to ask for 10 or 20 to happen at the same time is perhaps our weakness. But it's also a different approach to education. It's a different approach to how laptops communicate. It's a different approach to software development. It's an endless list. And, you know, just to look at how the community and open source supports software, it's a cultural phenomenon. It's really a very, very different way to support both content and software. And consumers are starting to understand this. If 10 years ago I had told you that it would be possible for an encyclopedia to be built by the people and I gave you the complete story, you would dismiss it, and yet the Wikipedia exists. So the OLPC story is the same sort of thing. And what people do is, and I'll use the Wikipedia, they sort of now look at it from the point of view of Encyclopedia Britannica. And yes, there's imperfect information in there. Yes, there are errors in there. Yes, and I can critique it from the point of view of the Encyclopedia Britannica, but I'm not. It's like the economist that said you can't touch type on it. Well, who can't touch type on it? Fat-fingered adults can't touch type on it. But kids do just fine with that keyboard. The fact that it happens to work underwater, that it can be, you know, you hose it down when it gets dirty, and these other properties that are absolutely critical, but really don't make too much difference, you know, in an office building on Park Avenue.
One of your main priorities is getting the volume to reduce the cost and you know, for manufacturing. But obviously the kind of $100 laptop tagline that emerged, there's kind of been a bit of a chain around your neck, really, hasn't it, in terms of, because the price was above that.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter.
What's going on?
In fact, for Rwanda and Afghanistan and Cambodia, it's the $0 laptop. Okay, we just financed it in a different way. The fact that it costs $187 or $188 to manufacture today is just, you know, today's price. I can just do nothing but close my eyes, and in a year from now, it'll be 30% less. That's just what the chips and everything else will do on their own without any intervention. Now, there are 900, believe it or not, pieces in that machine. If I reduce the number 900 to 50, I'm going to chop another 40% off the price. So all I need to do is very little except integration plus time, is going to bring it down to $100. So I'm there, I'm just not there today.
Nicholas Negroponte, founder of One Laptop Per Child, speaking with our own Bobby. Now, Bobby, how viable is it really in the outcomes?
He told me what the figures are projected for this year. So now they've moved to this kind of get one, give one model of distributing, as well as trying to make deals with governments. They're seeing the uptake increase. So they've got 500,000 orders in the bag, and they expect by the end of 2008 that to be up to 2 or 3 million. Now, they remain kind of optimistic despite the negative attention that the project's been getting and the difficulties they have with competition with other companies who maybe aren't acting in a way that they feel is entirely fair. But I think what they're really looking at is the kinds of technologies they're rolling out here, the power-saving technologies, the screens that are efficient and bright. As he said, you know, maybe if every kid ends up with a laptop, that's a good thing. If they're our laptops, great. If they're not, we don't care that much. So I think, you know, they're having the market impact that they wanted. The question really is whether they come out of it with a good news story or a bad news story.
I like his thing of, I've got it, I just haven't got it today. I think I'm going to, you know, use that myself for all my homework and things.
Yeah, next time I have to file some copy back for the paper, I'll let them know.
Well, thank you very much for that, Bobby, and more from One Laptop and Negroponte over the next few months. That's almost it from this week's Tech Weekly. But before we go, Charles, what have we got in store for the technology section and The Guardian on Thursday?
We're going to be looking at whether the market that's being created for security companies paying hackers to tell them about vulnerabilities is creating a sort of balkanization of security. We'll be rounding up all the Macworld announcements, looking at global broadband growth or slowing of same. A new technology from UCLA called CarTorrent. You can sort of guess what that's about. How North and South Korea are getting together to build a new version of Linux. The Free Our Data campaign were reporting on a bar camp to produce a web service that everyone will be able to use. And Andrew Brown talks about the fastest computer that he ever used and owned, which had four shades of orange on the screen and a 20 megabyte disk.
And on next week's podcast, we're taking a backwards look at technology with Dave Edgerton. He's the author of The Shock of the Old, and we'll also be rounding off Macworld. Which reminds me, if there's anything that you'd like Bobby to check out on your behalf, please do send your suggestions to tech@guardian.co.uk. That's tech, T-E-C-H, @guardian.co.uk. In the meantime, Charles has asked me to read this, his personal favorite comment from last week on the blogs. It comes from the CES, Arvidia Reports, and that leopard print taser, which you heard about earlier in the program. C.S. Clark quotes, "And why would you give someone a taser for Valentine's Day?" And he says, "Because you think they're stunning." Thanks as always to Jemima and Charles in the studio, Bobby in the US, and Scott, our producer and the man behind the curtain. I'm Alex Krotowski. Thank you very much for pushing the Tech Weekly podcast to number 7 in the iTunes chart.
Woo-hoo!
Which was very cool. Let's see if we can get it to number 1. Thanks very much. See you next week.
Guardian Unlimited.